Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show with today's guest, Chris Lynch, principal at Code Red Consultants. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. In today's show, Chris will explain what a code consultant does, what a code compliance alternative is, and talk in depth about the new requirement for third-party inspections on fire stopping. We'll then move to business. You'll gain knowledge on how Code Red had such rapid growth in a traditionally stagnant market. Chris will dive into accountability of leadership, compensation, being a renaissance consultant, and there's plenty of talk of culture, burnout, work-life balance, and the two that no one thinks of when they think code consultants, which is hustle and grind. If you've ever thought about starting your own business, you'll want to listen up. Enjoy the show. Chris Lynch, principal at Code Red Consultants. Welcome to the construction. I do this every single time. Mass Construction Show.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for coming by. This is kind of an odd first question, but I think there's a fair amount of the population in the construction industry that don't necessarily even know what a code consultant firm does. So before we start diving into too much, can you just explain what a code consultant does and then what do you guys do that's kind of above and beyond? And
sure. Different? Yeah, no, it's, beyond just the construction industry, I think general population in general, when I'm trying to tell somebody what I do, it's not a one sentence conversation. So it's a fair question. So code consultants, I guess, in its simplest form, are experts generally in building and fire code compliance. So, as you get into designing a building as early as concept level is, what's the construction type need to be? How big can the building be? Where can it be located in terms of siding requirements? What do the exterior walls need to be? So stuff that any architect could look up or other designer. However, as you know, the building code is a complicated thing with a lot of different options in it. So it kind of lends itself to a niche market where you've got these specialty consultants, co-consultants, that are well-versed in kind of navigating through all of these complicated matters and articulating that to their clients. So I guess in the simplest form, that's what a code consultant does. My background is in fire protection engineering, and that's what our firm specializes in. And when you combine that background with code consulting, you also end up getting into a lot of the alternative compliance methods. So fire modeling, egress modeling, things that go beyond the prescriptive requirements of the building code where, hey, the code might say we can't put glass here, but we want to have this, large atrium with fire-rated walls but have a lot of glazing. Is there a way to justify that and go through an alternative means compliance method, which is allowed by code but requires a lot of basically engineered solutions? So we get into a lot of kind of those situations that are outside of the prescriptive world of the building code and trying to solve practical challenges that way.
So what you're describing is you're working with a owner or an architect on the front end. Let's say you're too close on a lot line, so you would need to have a rated structure. You want to go with glass. You would offer them a code compliance alternative in that case. Like, how would that example play out? Do you need to stamp that? What's the process look like?
So generally, anytime we're sitting at a table, we want to understand whoever our client is and what their objectives are. So if it's an owner and they're looking for a certain aesthetic, and we can say, hey, the code's going to not allow you to put that type of a wall here, but here are alternative options and maybe paint 1 to 6 different options and trying to articulate costs and constructability concerns with each of those so they can make an educated decision. And as part of that context, we might be bringing up things like, hey, to do this process, we need a compliance alternative approved by the local building official and can articulate, generally that's a pretty significant ask. It's probably going to have to go to the state level for a variance and then trying to articulate what are the odds that variance gets approved. And those sorts of things. So it the whole process in terms of the consulting side of it is just goes way beyond code knowledge, trying to understand schedule concerns, constructability concerns, really getting at what the drivers are for the client to make a decision and trying to get them all that information so that they can make an educated decision.
Yeah. And having some idea of process, right? Like what you just mentioned. You submit to the local is most likely, so let's just follow through. So you design a system, say, hey, we don't meet the prescriptive measures of the code. here's our code compliance alternative, designed and stamped.
Yep.
Give that to the AHJ. AHJ can either, by code, can either accept, or what would you say, more likely rejects and sends you to the Board of Appeals, the State Board of Appeals, Building Code Board of Appeals?
Yeah, you know, it's up to each AHJ of mm-hmm. their comfort level. The building code gives them the discretion to accept compliance alternatives, as they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are some guidelines out there for what might be acceptable. So some authorities are more willing to entertain those than others.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would say far more often than not, they would defer to the state. The formal process requires a rejection letter. Generally, mm-hmm. it's not that they're necessarily rejecting it per se, as much as they're deferring that decision yeah. and saying, you know,
they want to cover themselves.
Right. We yeah. essentially want to pass that liability to somebody at the state level, the appeals board, to make yeah. the call on it.
Okay. And that's obviously important knowledge for a owner or developer that, hey, this code situation potentially sends you to the Board of Appeals, the State Board of Appeals for Building Code, which could be X number of weeks or months.
Sure.
Somebody looking to get a permit, try and get a shovel on the ground, it's critical for financing or whatever, this obviously can matter. So that's where you guys are kind of,
yep,
I think, become a big service, right? A critical service, and where, in fairness to the designers, architects and engineers, I was talking to one architect, a guy that owned a firm, and you know, he was saying, we used to be able to just know the code, and it was one book, you know.
Yep.
Now it's six books, continues to get more and more complicated, and now they just don't have anyone internally, and it just makes sense to farm out to a code consultant, because to have that level of expertise in everything is just not reasonable. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting process that most people don't know ever happens. They think they go down and file for a building permit and go through some machinations and get a permit, but it can be quite involved. Now, will you guys do just strictly fire, life safety, or do you have folks in-house that will do like AAB, Architectural Access Board, things like that? Will you?
Yeah, well, our educational backgrounds are heavy in fire and, mm-hmm. and building. We end up, I think, just inherently out of being in the code consulting market, have mm-hmm. to get into some other discipline. So we do Architectural Access Board or AAB,
yeah.
And as well as get into some of the plumbing code, some of the energy code, getting into scoping requirements on, you know, existing building triggers for structural upgrades, anything like that. So it does bring us into some other disciplines where we try to draw the line at saying, you know, we can help you with scoping criteria of the application of the code, but the actual details of the context of those requirements, you're going to probably have to talk to your mechanical engineer, your structural engineer, whoever it is, because they're more familiar with the application side of it. But we can get you through the code path to, you know, figure out, you know, which avenue to go down.
Okay. So far, we've talked really traditional code yep. consulting, right? In that, I guess my one last question around traditional code consulting is, where are you typically brought in the process? Is it feasibility stage, or are you ever kind of forced in later in the game? How does that typically work?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So it's a little all over the map, I would say. The most typical is if we're being hired by an architect, they're generally bringing us on at early schematics.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sort of end up with this iterative process through each design phase, schematics, design development, construction documents. Again, then very limited involvement during the construction phase traditionally, where we've worked sometimes with developers or some architects. They'll bring us in as early as concepts to try to get building massing, building siting, things like that
mm-hmm.
nailed down. And then there's other clients that they don't use code consultants very heavily, but all of a sudden they're caught in a pickle and they need a permit yesterday and they call yeah. you up and you've had no involvement in the project and it's kind of,
I love
you know, all hands on deck
yeah.
type of, so it really does kind of span the spectrum of the design process.
Okay. And now how about outside of typical code consulting? You and I probably ad nauseum have discussed and heard about NFPA 241. I know you sure. guys do those plans? So that kind of, now you move to start working with general contractors. So what else are you guys doing outside of maybe traditional co-consulting?
Yeah, so probably one of the things that's very different about our firm than most of our direct competitors would be that we kind of have co-consulting as maybe half our business. And then the other half is a multitude of different sort of field-related services or consulting services, maybe more tiered towards construction. So it really started with smoke control special inspections that became a code requirement a few editions ago. Our background as fire protection engineers lends itself very well to serving in that function, where we're going out working with the contractors and all the trades to basically run integrated testing of the smoke control system with fire alarm and electrical systems, making sure the sequence of operations worked correctly. That was a requirement of the code in Boston Fire, as well as, you know, Cambridge and many other jurisdictions heavily enforced that requirement in the code. So that got us in front of a lot of contractors. And then once we were there, contractors started to say, well, what else do you do? Other regulatory changes happen at the same time. So you get this NFPA 241 requirement comes out. Our background as co-consultants and fire protection engineers, again, lends itself very well to writing impairment plans, dealing with temporary construction challenges that might be outside the prescriptive realm of the code. So there's
fuel storage, hot work.
Can I put a dumpster in the building? If I really need to, how would I accomplish that? Yeah. You know, those sorts of things. Interfacing with the fire department on what might be an acceptable mitigation for a temporary construction. All of those sorts of negotiations kind of fell into that. Then we ended up doing other things. We service healthcare clients pretty heavily. They have certain requirements on maintaining firewalls, fire doors, dampers, fire stopping. So several of us lived in that sort of world, helping them with regulatory compliance. And then at the same time, there's been more code requirements coming out for special inspections of those systems. So, you know, there's another side where we're regularly out in the field auditing firewall construction, fire stopping, testing fire doors, looking at fire dampers, trying to develop custom solutions to maybe constructability challenges associated with anything having to do with path of fire resistance. So, you know, this sort of field suite of services, if you will, just kind of continues to grow. And I think the interesting thing we found is the value add side to the contractors, while our core clients traditionally were more on the design side, you know, they're finding our custom solutions and ability to be reactive in a tight time period, I think, to be a big value to the construction process. So we're finding ourselves there more and more.
Okay. I do want to dive into fire stopping. I want to take a break so we don't completely code overload folks, because you and I would like to talk about it for, well, maybe we wouldn't, but I'm going to take a turn and let's just talk kind of about Code Red as a business. I've been kind of fascinated by the fact that you guys started, what, you're almost 5 years into it?
Yeah, we'll be five in August.
Okay. And most people don't think of, if they even know that code consulting exists, they don't think of code consulting as a growth market, or, like, you know, it's not tech, it's not, you know, oh, we're booming. But for some reason, you guys went from three partners and then, you know, pretty much 3 to 30 in a relatively short period of time or maybe I'm off on the total number.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm guessing
mid-20s now.
Mid-20s,
yeah,
sorry.
Not quite
pushing
30 yet.
Yeah.
Appreciate the
I'll
optimism.
Give you a few more. But still, that's pretty rapid growth in a traditionally stagnant kind of, maybe stagnant's not fair, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of motion. It was design handed over to the co-consultants, get their, you know, get their input, make the decisions based off of their input. So how does somebody that's in kind of a pretty stable traditional market start a company and then grow and get noticed and recognized and kind of be like,
I don't want to feel like I'm just blowing smoke because you're sitting here, but then become an industry leader in less than 5 years. That's pretty impressive. I mean, if you look at, you know, there's the Cosentinis and R.W. Sullivans and Jensen Hugheses of the world, and they've been solid and stable and kind of, you know, moving along, but you don't see growth out of them typically. So how did you do that from a business perspective?
Sure.
You know, was it?
I'd like to say that was, you know, when we started day one, this was the 5-year plan and we've hit the mark, but it's certainly been a moving target. And I think there were a lot of factors at play. The first one, when we started the firm, myself, Carl Nelson, and Nate Birmingham, you know, it's one of the kind of the founding principles that we wanted is really accountable leadership. You know, so as we think about in our industry, right, there's not anything we're selling other than basically our knowledge base. So for us to retain really the best talent, that we felt really compelled that we had to kind of lead from the top, meaning heavy practicing engineers at the leadership level, kind of setting the pace, not sort of the traditional bait and switch approach where you get a lot of younger engineers and then you sort of pull the leaders back and they're back in the office and maybe leading a different lifestyle than the guys on the ground. So that was one of the things, and we wanted to set up a compensation model that also allowed our employees to work like owners, right? So we wanted to basically align our motivational factors with our employees so that we're always kind of headed in the same direction, very clear on our objectives, and get everyone moving in the same direction. You know, at the same time, I think that structure lends itself well to being, you know, nimble, responsive, reactive. You know, we had this motto, we're going to put our clients' needs ahead of our own, meaning for us to earn clients' trust, we were going to drop basically everything and kind of push the bounds of our personal comfort to really hustle and grind. And, you know, if it's Saturday and you need us, we're there. If it's late at night, you know, we're going to be responsive and get back to you quicker than what you're experiencing elsewhere in the industry. So that was one of the differentiating factors that I think has carried through even through today, because that business model, I think, has proven itself to actually be a worthwhile one. I mean, the other external factors were a huge part of it. I mean, timing, you know, from when we started in 2013 to now, we went through quite a building boom. So that opens up the market quite a bit. There were several regulatory changes, right? We talked a little bit about, you know, smoke control was kind of on the way up at the time that we started the company. You add in NFPA 241, you add in some of the fire stopping stuff and other regulations that have continued to increase. You know, those services, we, given our entrepreneurial spirit, I think we attack those maybe in a more aggressive manner than some of our competitors. And also it's a little bit of a different business model than just being a traditional co-consultant like we talked about, but our ability to sort of gain market share there, I think, quickly helped expedite the growth. And then, you know, our business model of putting our best people in front of the clients, we don't do a lot of traditional marketing or business development, but, you know, I'm on site probably 4 days a week at meetings or on construction sites in front of a multitude of different people. And, you know, people I haven't maybe been exposed to on newer projects, I get in through the architect or the owner, and all of a sudden now I'm talking to the contractor or somebody else. And that sort of just continual referral process and demonstrating our knowledge has helped, I think, really expedite our growth. So in that way, getting your best people in front of the clients and having them set a kind of a pace in the office for others to follow has given them good motivation. So I think all those things combined sort of help get us to where we are.
Okay. Do you feel like there's any culture involved there? I mean, some of the stuff you just talked about by whether it's compensation structure or following the lead of the people at the top rather than just selling something and then having some lower level person do the legwork on it, you know, where you guys are intimately involved at the top, compensation structure, creativity, that kind of, I'm sure, creates a culture whether you intend it or not. But do you feel like folks might be looking at your place as not so kind of stodgy or
practical? That was very much part of what we wanted when we set the company up, is we looked at where did we like to go to work? Well, we wanted to go to work. You know, it's being a consultant is not a 40-hour a week job generally. Mm-hmm. You're so tied into one construction schedules or design schedules. Yeah. You need to be responsive and reactive to your clients' needs, which a lot of times you're not going to be able or have the luxury of time to handle those sorts of things. So on the other side, you know, we wanted flexible work hours. We wanted a casual work environment, understanding that, look, do a smoke control test. You're probably out late at night because you're testing those systems when the building's not occupied, or you're doing it on the weekend. Yeah. So to expect the same guy to come back at 8 a.m. to show face in a typical corporate structure is just not going to lend itself well to retention, right? No, so
yeah. It's just bad business, I think.
So we wanted to have a certain lifestyle, kind of family culture. A lot of us had played athletics or been part of other teams. So we wanted to sort of create this family team atmosphere where, you know, on one side, we kind of work hard, play hard sort of structure where we've done things like go zip lining or whitewater rafting or try to get everyone out of the office and work in a cohesive way, which is a challenge with co-consulting because usually if someone's hiring us, it's maybe one or two people serving them. We're not going out generally with a team of, you know, 10 of our engineers to serve one client. So how to get that sort of cross sharing in the office and not set up all these little fiefdoms was a challenge. You know, so we got open office space. We have regular trainings every month internally where we're sharing information across each other, trying to cross pollinate expertise as much as possible. And the result is you get, I think, more of a complete consultant where, yes, I do code, but also know fire stopping, but I also can talk about smoke control special inspections. I can talk about 241, you know, can interface. So now when I'm at the table representing all these things to a client, you're not having to jump around person to person. You have a very knowledgeable source. And at times I may need to go back to the team and say, you know, let me go tap into Pete's 241 knowledge because maybe it's a little deeper than mine or something like that, then we can do that. But to have sort of what we like to call like a renaissance consultant where they're really knowledgeable in all things that, you know, we do and that may be useful to a client.
Yeah. No, that's great. Do you, how you described it, and I know you talked about the, you know, the case where you're doing smoke control testing and, you know, you encourage them not to come in. Sometimes it's hard to break, you know, where, no, I really mean don't show up here.
Sure.
You know, where some people are compelled to show up, you know. Do you find that at all? Like, 'cause the way I look at it is there's probably a good chance for burnout in your business. People might not think about that.
Yep.
But if you really think about the way people act when they need a permit or they need an occupancy, and you're part of that mix on a regular basis. So it's crisis management a lot of the times, right? That's going to be tough on people that work there to some degree. So you struggle with that at all as far as trying to...
Yeah, I think that's honestly, it's probably one of our biggest challenges. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, our growth has probably outpaced our projections you know, regularly. So one of the things we've been challenging is continually adding, you know, we wanted a certain level of technical expertise in what we do. So we just don't want to go find a body necessarily to hire to solve our problems. They have to be the right fit culturally and technically. So we have been fortunate where we've, I think, been able to actually bring in a lot of experienced engineers, not just hiring straight out of feeder programs, which has helped. We're trying to catch up on that front so that we can level hours off, but it's something we monitor literally weekly and try to have conversations with our staff, and we're constantly kind of talking about balance and burnout. The one nice thing about growing to the size that we have now is you have more opportunity for sharing that burden on a case-by-case basis than we did 2 or 3 years ago when there were 10 of us, you know, so... I think it's improving. It continues to be something we monitor and really trying to struggle to right size because, you know, I grew up in the last recession. You know, we started work and people were, so that's always in the back of my head and trying to create, atmosphere where we're ready for the good times as well as the bad times, but also are keeping up with good project work and good clients and all those demands when it's busy. So it is a challenge.
No, it's good. All right, now I got to get away. Those were my selfish questions. So hopefully there's a good group of people listening that are interested in that kind of business type stuff. But that was more me. I was kind of curious about how you guys did it because you were really successful. Let's hop back on the code side for a bit. There's been a few big things that have happened lately. I think to serve the group that's listening, I'd like to talk a little bit about the new fire stopping requirement. And maybe if you can just kind of run folks through just the really high level, when someone needs to comply with it, percentages, maybe a few common issues you see on projects. So, I'll lead you in. So this past January, this is a building code requirement, Chapter 17. Again, similar to the special inspection issue, they now require fire stopping in certain conditions. I don't even want to say they're not even occupancies. I'll just leave it at conditions. So can you walk people through what that what that means, where it happens, that type of thing?
Yeah, so the requirement is for fire stopping special inspections of both through penetrations of walls, floors, as well as joints in high-rise buildings, as well as other what I'll call important buildings. So they reference a structural table, certain importance factors, but it basically boils down to large assembly, healthcare, first responder type occupancies, public utility stations, things that where if a fire were to break out, you are have a higher risk profile of that occupancy.
Yeah. The other big one, education.
Right.
Because that will affect a lot of people
listening. College or university buildings with an occupant load of more than 500. And that's based not on actual headcount, but that's your calculated egress loading, which anyone who's ever done those knows is more conservative than what generally the building experiences on a day-to-day basis. So that's going to grab a large percentage of college buildings that are low-rise.
K through 12, same condition, right?
I believe so,
Yeah. Okay, so education, we're generalizing here, but education, healthcare, any high-rise application, anything utilities, water, gas, power plants, and
first responder type, and also as prisons are, not ones that comes up all the times, but basically help, you can look at any sort of group I occupancy, right, healthcare or prisons. Those people don't leave the building in a fire, right. So those certainly get qualified.
Okay. So they're the ones that need to comply. And then what does this compliance look like?
Sure. I would say fire stopping was the most incorrectly installed fire protection system. And I'm being kind by that. The industry standard was basically put red fire caulking around holes is sort of what was there. What people don't realize is the code hasn't changed relative to what was required. It always required what's called listed fire stop assemblies, right? And this is an assembly like any other fire assembly. If you've ever looked at a wall, it's very detailed, right? And basically they give you a recipe for exactly how something was passed the fire test. So if it was a wall, you get 3 5/8 inch metal studs with 5/8 inch type X gypsum wallboard on each side. They tell you how far the screws need to be spaced apart, where the joints need to lap on the studs, how the tape and mud need to goes on, right? It's the whole recipe for how the thing goes together. And to maintain the listing, you have to build it exactly to that standard.
Yeah, and I think, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think it's helpful for folks to use the actual phrase, right? Which is, it's an assembly.
Yep.
Right? And a lot of people, even on a exterior wall, they'll say, okay, well, I'm using R21 insulation, so the R value on this wall is 21. No, it's not. The R value of the insulation is 21, but the entire assembly might be 16. So, what you are describing is that whole assembly matters, not just the fact that you would think the fire caulking gets you some magic rating. It's the assembly that gets you the rating, right?
Right. So any manufacturer's fire caulking or whatever other fire stopping material does not, like you said, carry a rating. That is a fire stopping product. The assembly carries a rating, which is all components. So the wall or floor you're going through, the type of penetrating item or items that you have, so a single cast iron pipe versus a cable bundle versus I've got a cast iron pipe with an insulated pipe with a piece of cable in the same opening, that's a different assembly than each one of those on their own. The size of the opening, the spacing of any of the penetrants, the depth of the fire stopping, the type of the fire stopping, what other fire stopping products you may need beyond just the actual material. Mm-hmm. You know, as a rule of thumb, I tell people is you got to think of these things, really understand the way they're fire tested. They go through a furnace with a burn test for a certain amount of time. And at the end, they hit it with a hose stream. And that's to really simulate, most people think it's to simulate firefighting activities. It's not. It's to simulate basically thermal shock or other factors that happen in a fire relative to pressure differentials mm-hmm. that really can't be simulated in a furnace. So they hit it with a hose stream for a period of time across the whole assembly. And any basically one side of that wall or floor you hit is generally sacrificial, meaning if it's a gypsum wall, that first layer of gypsum is completely gone. Then you're hitting, you know, the backside of this fire stopping with a hose with a lot of pressure. So that needs to stay in place. So that big openings don't do well in that sort of a thing. So if you have large openings with a pipe going through it, you're generally needing to add things like sheet metal with certain type of fasteners or metal scrim or other sorts of things that are going to hold that fire stopping in place, because there's really no structural integrity to those products to leave them in place. So you get these large openings. We end up, you know, really the pain as people have started to go through this inspection process is drywall patching. You know, the drywall construction is a huge part of the fire stopping. Mm-hmm. So even if you go sole source and you get a well-trained fire stop installer, they have to work hand in hand with the drywall construction guys so that they know when you're hanging the sheetrock around a pipe, cut that hole to within a half inch, not 3 inches, because you've got no chance of installing a compliant fire stop system if the hole's too big in the first place. So in a nutshell, the listed fire stop assemblies are generally coming from you're going to work hand in hand with some sort of fire stop manufacturer, you know, whoever it is on a given project. They generally help that installing contractor build a submittal book of these details that will show every single type of penetration or joint you're going to have on that building. Those go in to the architect. They get approved on the project. And then the special inspectors, literally their job is to go out and compare these listed assemblies that are in the submittal to what was installed. And we don't have a lot of leeway for giving any sort of grace outside of what's in that listed assembly. Our job is essentially to compare the two things. Okay. So this anything beyond that has to go back to the building official if it deviates in some way, shape, or form.
And the types, the options for inspections?
So you can either witness 10% get installed or destructively test 2% of each type of fire stopping, and that's taken on a per floor basis. And if your floor is greater than 10,000 square feet, you break that down into inspection areas that are no greater than 10,000 square feet. So it gets tricky. We're finding more often than not we're doing the destructive option, just from a time on site standpoint for the inspector. It seems to be more cost effective for the owners to do it that way. But now you're balancing the number of inspections with construction progress and getting access to these things. So it becomes a heavy scheduling issue with the contractors, and it's something to add in to their schedules they've never had to before, which creates another level of complexity.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to make an assumption here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like anything that is new, I'm assuming the pass rate has not been fantastic out of the gate.
That's fair. Yeah. Like any new code requirement, you know, it can be very painful if you're not prepared for it. So we try to push heavy education and training up front before any install happens, so people are on notice as to, hey, you're going to be inspected differently. Here's what a listed fire stop assembly is, and we kind of start at the beginning. The success rate is better when we do those sorts of things. Usually there's still a 1 or 2 month period of higher level of failures as they start to do the installation and kind of experience it firsthand. And then generally we're finding the pass rates improve significantly over the course of the project from there on out.
Yeah. I mean, and most people are probably thinking like, this doesn't seem like potentially that big of an issue, but if you're trying to close up a ceiling and now you can't close up a ceiling because you're going through all these machinations about, you know, cutting open the fire stopping, you failed, now checking all the penetrations again. Do like there's days, right?
Yeah.
And on a 6-week schedule, if you're losing, you know, 2 or 3 days because of fire stopping issues, that's obviously a problem. So this is a real issue. A lot of people that I talk with and mention that, hey, there's this new fire stop requirement. Like, oh, yeah, okay, what do I got to do? The folks really need to pay attention because this affects construction schedule immensely. There's probably a pretty decent cost associated with this. I mean, you're going to start dealing with subcontractors and whether you want to bring it in-house with sole source or rely on the subs. Are the subs that you have installing, are they knowledgeable? So there maybe has to be an education process. Is it something you want to call out in your contract? You know, at least so it's put up front that, hey, this is a new standard, even though they technically own all applicable codes and standards. But I think for GCs, it makes sense to call this out. This is the standard you're going to be expected to comply with, because it might be fine to say, okay, well, they own it. But at the end of the day, if it's affecting everybody on the job, it doesn't solve you. It doesn't help you to say, okay, they own it, right?
So we found exactly that as we start the process, it kind of gets, okay, fire stopping, it's not that complicated. But they've never thought about it in the way that it actually needs to get done. At the installation level, you have to coordinate across trades. So there was never, I'm finding, a point in these foreman meetings where, you know, if it was the duck guy who's hanging duck and his fire stop assembly called for framing, you know, the framing member on the annular space needs to be within 2 inches. Well, that might mean that the drywall guy now needs to hang an additional stud and box out around that duct before the sheetrock goes up. You know, how does that conversation happen? How does that communication occur? Those sorts of things have just never been in the process.
Yeah.
And then to think about how you're delivering a space, and we talk to the GCs to say, look, the most efficient way for you to control how many destructive inspections you have is to try to give us as big of areas at a time up to that 10,000 square foot number.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm servicing a 10,000 square foot area and I need to do 2%, you know, that might mean in that 10,000 square foot area, maybe it's 10 or 15 destructive inspections. If they all pass, that's it, right? And I just visually walk through and make sure everything else is done, but I'm not doing a detailed inspection on those other ones. I'm just visually making sure they're in. If you're going to give me room by room, you know, those inspection blocks get much lower. Then you extrapolate that over the process, the number of visits, the number of destructive inspections, and the potential points of failure go way up.
Yeah, and that's all coordination, right? Yeah. Coordination between the duct guy and the drywall, coordination between the you guys and the superintendent or the trades to try and get you bigger blocks. So there's a lot there, and people really need to pay attention because I think it's a time and money issue.
Substantial. And the risk factor is, you get to the end of the job, maybe you didn't do it, or, you know, we have had some people that kind of ignore it, and they say, okay, we're on board, but we'll get you out here, and then walls are closed in, or things are inaccessible. Well, if I can't give my report to the building inspector is not going to sign the building off without the special inspection report. So then you're cutting into walls or ceilings that are done to gain access. That's hopeful that they're even done right. Then we're likely finding they probably weren't done or done correctly, and now there's additional rework in those areas. And if the space is right at that finish line, it really gets
this could
to be a tumultuous situation.
Good word. I was going to say a mess. You're much more sophisticated than me. So let's bounce back. Having myself again, I'm going to get selfish here again. So just recently, having started a business myself, and you know, I imagine there's other folks that hopefully will be listening to this. The four of you that are listening, maybe one of you want to start a business. You know, maybe they're working somewhere, whether they're an engineering firm, or an architect, or a PM at a general contractor or a subcontractor, or whatever. That, you know, thinking they might like to start a business on their own. You know, what was kind of the thought process you went through? Did you see an opening in the market? Was it really what you were talking about, which is, you know, the way it was set up, you felt like it was, you know, things might not have been set up right. And then how tough was it? You know, how tough was it to set up a corporation? How tough was it to get insurance? What was that like when you were, you know, early on just starting this thing out and you made an agreement with, you know, your partners and then decided to get going? Like what happened there?
Yeah. It's all good questions. So the, I guess to start at the beginning, the sort of, the idea of doing it on our own was sort of born out of one. We thought there was an opportunity in the market, a bigger opportunity for, doing work the way that we wanted to do work, where we felt like name the other firm that you could go work for, not just necessarily our employer at the time, but anyone really in the industry. Mm-hmm. We didn't feel like the alignment of the structure was there to allow the engineers to function in the way we felt like they needed to successfully serve the clients. There was always some sort of business component or corporate mentality that sort of drew a line as to how far people would be willing to go to serve the clients. And I personally struggled, and I think that my partners would say they did as well, drawing that line, because you know, a client can be a great relationship. And once you've developed that relationship, you know, you want it to deliver for them like they're your friend. Mm-hmm. You know, so to draw these boundaries, because that's where the company kind of says, no, that's going to work. We're going to stop. It's hard to do. So we wanted to, you know, we saw an opportunity that way to say, maybe we can do this a little different. And we liked the idea of a small local business. We were, you know, between 29 and 30, all three of us, when we started the company. We were looking to set up a place that we could work for a long time the way we wanted to do work.
And wanted to work.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So that was sort of the drivers behind why we made the decision to do it. Also, I mentioned before, we sort of grew up in the recession. I had an opportunity to run an office at what at the time was Rolf Jensen and Associates for a while. So I had been able to see sort of the administrative side of the house, so to speak. And we wanted a conservative business model, because if we're going to be a small business, you know, we want to make sure this is a place we're not going to be laying people off. So to mm-hmm. start, we went in kind of with a goal that we were going to finance ourselves. We weren't going to take outside financing, even loans from a bank. So that meant we sucked it up for a while, and we didn't get paid for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months to kind of get it going. And get enough inertia going that we could sort of bankroll ourselves. And that was difficult and challenging. You know, we were really grinding, working really long days for months on end mm-hmm. with no direct compensation. But at the same time, obviously, you're kind of just riding the wave of...
You're investing.
Yeah.
It's a form of investment, right? You're just investing your time in that business.
Sure. So I mean that sacrifice has proven itself, and we've tried to continue that mentality going forward as we've grown to fund our growth in a what we think is a responsible way. Mm-hmm. But that was a challenge. You know, a lot of people, we were fortunate all of our wives worked and were able to, you know, support basically that investment of time and have the households function. And at the time, you know, Carl and I didn't have any children. Nate had just had a child, so we were sort of just at that starting point for our families where mm-hmm. the risk was a little lower. That, you know, it would have been tougher to do that now where we all have young children, sort of thing. So timing, again, came into play.
Yeah.
But it was a challenge for sure.
I like that you're honest. It's like there's that, and you might not have expressed it exactly this way, but there's that kind of constant fear, right? When you're first starting, you know, like, all right, let's not take the loans. Let's just try and hang on for as long as we can before we need to take any money out of this. And it seems like that's a theme. Like, I feel the same way. You know, like, my wife is not working at this time, so it was even more pressure, you know, so we had some savings and, you know, trying to make it work. And, you know, I hold off writing any checks from the business account as long as I possibly can, you know, just because you want to be prepared for if things slow down and you don't have that cash flow, like you need to, you know, you need to survive. And you guys are in that, you know, we're in that same mode. You don't want to lay people off. And then the other interesting theme is folks from successful businesses, and you mentioned it, like, always talk about their clients and making their clients happy. Bill Held, who also came on the podcast, had, and I'm going to probably butcher it a little bit, but I'll paraphrase. He kept hammering as we talk, he's like, you have to act as or he expected everybody that worked for Cardinal Group to act as an extension of the owner. You are an extension of the owner. That is your job, you know. And I remember listening to Matt Consigli one time. They are very much that way. You know, it seems like those are the people that are successful. If your job is to make people happy, you know, then, or if you come from a place of making my client satisfied, you're going to do well. There's actually been business lines that I feel like I could probably do pretty well in, but I didn't feel like the customer would be necessarily happy at the end of the day. Like, you get into permitting, right? There was one person in particular didn't have a history of what it takes to permit a project. So, you know, through my knowledge, I was able to expedite a permit pretty well because I was able to say, okay, you're not even at the review phase, but having had a conversation, I think you're mixing X, Y, and Z. So by the time the plans examiner gets your documents, you're just going to be getting a letter back asking for these things, and you're running around. So I was able to say, okay, hey, get X, Y, and Z. Let's get them in. Go see the health department. Get a stamp. Get that in. You know, and then the permit had already, I think, been in a month, and then within 3 weeks, they had a permit, and it had made its way through building and fire and everything. When it was all said and done, the person wasn't disappointed, but... Like, yeah, they had no idea. Like, I probably just lopped 4 months off of their time it would have taken them to get a permit, but they didn't understand that. And to them, it was only kind of like, okay, yes, I'm going to pay you because you did this. And they weren't dissatisfied, but they had no idea the value that was brought to them. And they're like, oh, all right, well, I paid you and it still took me 3 weeks to get it. It actually took me 7 weeks to get it because it was in there a month. Did you even help me? You know, like, so... I've internally looked at it and said, you know what, maybe I don't want to be in that side of the business because if the person doesn't understand what it takes, you know, they're not satisfied at the end.
They'll never know what success looks like. Yeah.
Right. So it's interesting. So even personally, I've looked at that like, you know, I want people that I work with to be satisfied and say, okay, great. I'm glad I worked with them, you know. Yeah. So that seems to be very much a theme that I see with the people that are successful. So hopefully I'm modeling that, and hopefully a year from now I'm successful too. But
I have no doubts.
Now, how about just the straight up just slog of, you know, dealing with attorneys, insurance, all that kind of stuff? What was that like? And
yeah, I mean, I would first off say I was fortunate in that I didn't start it on my own, right? There was three of us at the beginning, so that helped with the division of labor. If anyone's thinking about starting their own business, it was a lot, and that was divided by three for us, so I can only imagine doing it, you know, on your own. You know, we actually had reached out to, there was a small business that's funded by the government through Clark University. We had reached out to them. They sort of helped us with... You know, we had a business plan in mind, but they helped us with that process. And then they also had a litany of partners, right? So attorneys, accountants, insurance people that are all sort of tied into their program to help, you know, if people want to start a business, then, you know, here are some good vendors that are interested in helping you do so. So we were able to get a lot of good referrals directly out of that for those vendors. And I think the nice thing about the partners we've been able to find on those is they knew what we were going to go through, right? They knew it probably, they were investing in us in a way too, where, you know, upfront, we're not a big fish, right? So reaching out, maybe some firms are less likely to want to give you time and attention. These ones looked at it as, you know, maybe not every firm that comes from this small business program is going to be hit, but a couple may be, and it's worth riding the wave with them because you get that kind of loyalty built in upfront. So we get some good partners that way that were really knowledgeable about, hey, here's sort of the growth process and helped advise us beyond just being a, you know, someone that we needed to serve, that needed to serve us as well.
Yeah. And was it relatively simple? I mean, at that, once you learned.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I also had the benefit of having run an office. So everything wasn't new to me. I mean, certainly starting a business, some of the considerations, but like contracts, and you know, we knew sort of what insurance lines we would need, right? We had some sort of knowledge of the industry and what's typical, what's not typical, things to ask for. So in that way, we had a little bit of a leg up where we weren't, for someone starting out with kind of just, hey, it's a new business in its infancy and having to figure it all out. We had some institutional knowledge for the market.
So you didn't have to show up and say, hey, what do I need for insurance? You at least knew, okay, we need Arizona omissions.
Right. We knew what's what our typical COI ask is of an architect in their AIA agreements, mm-hmm. In terms of general liability, umbrella insurance, professional liability, those sorts of things, setting up our own terms and conditions for our proposals, then working on other legal agreements that we had to have in place. Those were new, setting up the business, what type of business you were going to set up. So we had a lot of meetings with our attorneys to kind of, you look in the crystal ball and okay, well, where do you want to go? Do you want to be a C corp? Do you want to be an S corp? Do you want to be an LLC? Do you want to be an LLC taxed as an S corp? Mm. That was all discovery of, okay, articulate to me what that means. Go home, do your homework, talk to a few different people, mm-hmm. Don't make rash decisions there because it's hard to change later. So you pretty much have to be comfortable with how you're setting yourselves up and have some sort of strategic vision of how you want to grow as you make those decisions.
Yeah. Was there a lot of just being a partnership? Was there, and not from a tax structure standpoint, but just in a business standpoint, was there a lot of guidance from attorneys that walked through like, okay, how does this get divided? What happens if one person wants out? Yeah. Like, was that a...
Yeah, that's, a lot of, I think, we get feedback from a lot of people that partnerships fail for a lot of different reasons. We had the fortunate, experience that myself, Nate, and Carl are all graduated from the same school at the same year. We didn't really necessarily all know each other well in college, but mm-hmm. we worked together for a long time. I think we naturally had complementary sort of skill sets, which really helped where we weren't kind of stepping on each other of, no, I want to do this, you want to do that, was... And I think the other big thing, and I hope they would echo the same thing about me, is I don't think we have a lot of ego issues among the partnership group, which has mm-hmm. been great. And hopefully that continues, because I think that's where stuff can get messy. And we try to have open and honest conversations weekly with each other. I mean, Pete Hare joined us mm-hmm. 18 months as another partner into the business. And, Pete's folded right in kind of along the same lines. And we meet every week and we kind of have to have open and honest, accountable conversations about each other. And I think one of the other unique things we kind of set as an objective from day one is we wanted equal ownership. And so no one could sort of throw their weight around, so to speak, in these conversations. So it's definitely a different structure than a typical hierarchical structure mm-hmm. that a company has. It's worked, I think, well for us. And, to our employees, I think one of the important messages we try to tell them about the equal partnership is no one person's individual needs or personal decisions are going to drive the business, meaning, hey, I want to retire, or something is going on, I need to offload the business, that it has to happen collectively, and that we're keeping the collective goal of the organization at the top, not any one person's personal drivers.
Yeah, driving the whole company.
Yeah, so I think our firm is probably fairly unique in the way that it's set up that way. I don't know that there's many out there that have had a lot of success with the equal partnership route. So we're fortunate that way.
Yeah, because you always hear the business case studies about, all these, preparations get put in. What if this person does this and that person, And I think attorneys are obviously always a little hyper...
Yeah,
they're trying to protect you.
To answer that question, the owners agreements, that took a long time to hammer out with a lot of hypothetical scenarios, but it's really important because we talked to our attorneys where they've seen other businesses fail is where there was either ambiguity or things not addressed of, if X happens, what happens to the business? So we spent a lot of time on that and really got a good, I think, ownership agreement in place that we all sort of know the rules to play by.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. Selfishly, I enjoyed this a lot.
Well, thanks for having me, Joe.
Yeah, no, and it seems like, I bet you folks listening, if they weren't familiar with some of this code stuff, hopefully they learned a lot, but it's great. Thanks,
Compass. All right, thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Can't thank you enough for listening to the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you loved what you heard. If you did, if you wouldn't mind heading over to SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever it is that you listen, and give us a rating. It would help us to get heard, which would be huge. Keep this thing going. If you want to get more involved, head over to massconstruction.org. You can see what we do there. You can also connect with us on LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook, all from that page, whatever your medium is that you prefer. And last thing I got to say is thank you, thank you, thank you. Whoa, woman, keep your hands away from me, yeah.